Robert Kraft is not someone I'd ever imagine as being a nice guy. I mean, how can you be a nice guy if you own the New England Patriots? Right? Everybody understand that, right? We all, most of you not. I mean, that's just a given, right? And yet, and I doubt very much that we have anything in common, right? I mean, he's fairly well off. I don't think we run in the same circles. I don't think I'll ever meet the guy, and I'm good with that. I'm fine with never meeting him. But there is something that I can get on board with. Kraft established the Foundation to Combat Anti-Semitism. And that's the group that recently launched the Stand Up to Jewish Hate campaign with the blue squares, if you've seen those. And in addition to the many versions of hate in the world that Christians should categorically oppose, one of them is certainly Jewish hate. We should stand up to Jewish hate. And really, it's startling how blatant anti-Semitism has become. Now, I actually do understand the argument from the far left. It's crazy and nuts. I understand the logic, though. So, when God in the Bible is not your foundation for morality, what do you do? It seems that the far left has grabbed hold of what my understanding is like a Marxist version of morality. It's based on power and those who have it. So if you have power, those in power are evil inherently, and those who don't have power are good. So the powerful are oppressors, and the powerless are oppressed. And this isn't the place to critique who's actually in charge now and who has power now. But that thinking has resulted in this idea that Israel represents the oppressor, and the people in Gaza represent the oppressed. And that's why it doesn't matter what Hamas has done or is doing. They're just in the category, the moral category of being good because they're oppressed. So the far left presents Israel as the bad guys, just inherently based on the situation. But here's the thing. It doesn't take but a modicum of knowledge about the Jewish people, the history of the Jewish people, the history of the Levant, to understand that they fit in the category of the oppressed. I mean, that is obvious. I mean, it is one of the most obvious facts of history. So what's going on in all this? You know, it's the same thing that's going on with the anti-Semitism on the far right. Isn't that odd? At the extremes of the political system, it's not the only places they're found, but at the extremes, you have open anti-Semitism. It's weird. This is a non-political issue, evidently. There's something else driving it. And you know what's worse than that? Anti-Semitism in the church shouldn't be there, but it is. Someone has described this oxymoronic reality, that anti-Semitic Christians, with a poem. How odd of God to choose the Jew, but not so odd as those who choose the Jewish God and hate the Jew. That's really odd, isn't it? It's not just odd, though. It's a travesty, and there are some famous examples of this in church history. And Kent Hughes pointed out one of the most famous, the reformer Martin Luther. At the beginning, he was very sympathetic towards Jewish people. And he really encouraged his fellow believers to reach out to them with the gospel, to reach out evangelistically. He had a pamphlet that he wrote towards the beginning that said, in it, he says, "I would advise and beg everybody to deal kindly with the Jews and to instruct them in the scriptures. In such a case, we would expect them to come over to us." But that's not what happened. He saw no success in his evangelism to Jewish people, and that seems to be what led him to really extreme hatred. Kent Hughes explained that he had some pamphlets at the end of his life, towards the end of his life, that advised Christians to destroy Jewish homes and synagogues, basically to rid the German lands of Jewish people. That was what he was going for. He writes in one of them, "To sum up, dear princes and nobles who have Jews in your dominions, if this advice of mine does not suit you, then find a better one, so that you and we may all be free of this insufferable devilish burden, the Jews." I mean, that utterly ignorant, backwards, unconscionable, and somebody that I actually respect some of the things that he said. We actually do worship a Jewish God. You know, Jesus is God. And Jesus is, not was, is Jewish. So, I mean, Revelation 7:9 talks about the heavenly scene where there's these people standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes and with palm branches in their hands. And guess what? These humans did not lose their ethnic distinctives. It's describing them as from every nation, from all tribes and peoples and languages. Jesus' humanity is that of a resurrected Jewish man even now. Even now at the right hand of the Father. So, how can we who profess faith in this Jewish Messiah take such an incongruent stance with his ethnic people? And I think part of that is at least aided by a misunderstanding of what Paul says in our passage this morning. At least a lack of understanding of Paul's answer to the question in our text this morning, which is, has God rejected Israel? And just understand, I am not saying that if somebody espouses a theology that says that God has rejected Jewish people, it inherently means that they're anti-Semitic. So don't hear me saying that. But I am saying that if we understand what Paul is saying in this passage, it very much argues against anti-Semitism. So in essence, Paul is responding in two ways to what he said up to this point. He's responding to really the middle section, from Romans 9:30 to 10:21, but he's also coming back to what he talked about at the very beginning in the first section, which is Romans 9:6 through 29. Really, all these chapters are about Israel's response to their Messiah and what it means. Paul is a Jewish believer, but he was vastly in the minority. He responded to Christ, but the majority of the people did not recognize Jesus as their Messiah. The majority of Jewish people were not experiencing what God had promised his people in the Old Testament. Only a few, like Paul, were beginning to experience the fulfillment of those promises. So Paul's addressing that issue. And he's addressed it from two angles. He's addressed it from the standpoint of what God is doing and from the standpoint of what Israel did when Jesus came. And so in Romans 9:30 through 20 to 10:21, the middle section, Paul explains the Jewish response to the Messiah. Israel did not accept that Jesus was the fulfillment of everything the old covenant law was pointing to. So Jesus, just as he says there and in those passages, Jesus is the fulfillment of the Mosaic law. He perfectly obeyed God's law. He walked blamelessly before his Father at every point in his life, and he perfectly fulfilled its righteousness. So, in fact, he's the living, breathing instantiation of the law, the Mosaic law, the righteousness that it talks about. He perfectly expressed that. And so everyone who believes in him, they experience the righteousness that he provided by union with him. They experience a righteous status because of his righteous status. The Jewish failure to respond is twofold. On the one hand, they pursued the law the wrong way. The Mosaic law, they pursued it as though they could get that righteous status by obeying the rules and regulations. That was never what the Mosaic law was about. It was never teaching that, never directing that that's how you are righteous. It was always pointing to Christ, as Paul points out. Christ is the fulfillment of that law. But when the goal of the Mosaic law arrived, the Jewish nation, they tripped over him because of their own efforts to try to make a righteousness for themselves. Now, the other side of that is their failure to believe in him when he arrived, to recognize that he's the divine Lord, to recognize that he had risen from the dead. And that wasn't because they hadn't been told or hadn't heard or hadn't known better. They were told. They had heard. They should have known better. They should have known what would happen when the Messiah came, because their scriptures said what would happen. But they failed to believe because they pursued the Mosaic law, not from the standpoint of faith, but from the standpoint of their own personal efforts. Now, Israel's failure isn't the only explanation for what's happened. And so their failure does show that they deserve what's happened to them, but it's not the full explanation of why this has happened where Israel has not believed. So in Romans 9, 6 through 29, the beginning of this section, as Douglas Moo puts it, Paul surveyed the history of God's promises in the past. So he showed how God's actions in the past fit with what was happening in the present. He was looking to the past. In our passage, Paul now turns to the present, and he explains what God is doing in the present. And he's going to go on in the rest of this chapter and talk about what God's going to do with Israel in the future. So in the first section, he talked about what God did with Israel in the past. Now he's turned to the present, and he will look at the future. So the question Paul answers in this passage is, has God rejected Israel? And what his answer does is it begins to explain how Christians should think about God's relationship with Israel. And that explanation should absolutely put to rest any idea that Christians can be anti-Semitic. That followers of the divine and Jewish Messiah can hate the Jewish people. It's not reasonable. It's not appropriate. It's very much wrong. And so as Paul answers this question, he describes God's present relationship with Israel in two ways. For the present, God has chosen a remnant in Israel and hardened the rest. That's what's happened in the present. So in verses 1 through 6, Paul explains that God has chosen a remnant. And in verses 7 through 10, he explains that God has hardened the rest. And so that's what we're going to look at. So let's look at the first part of Paul's argument, that God has chosen a remnant within Israel. And he sets this off. You can see there at the very beginning of chapter 11, he sets it off with the words, really, that say, so then I say. Those are a set of words in Greek that he uses at various places to start a new thought. And the ESV is right to translate that. It's perfectly right to translate I ask then, because the next thing that comes is a question. But the question, the way that the ESV words the question, I think isn't quite as clear as like the NASB and the NET do in bringing out this rhetorical question that he asks. They both translate it, God has not rejected his people, has he? And it's setting you up to answer no. That's the way the Greek words it. So not only does it assume a no answer, though, he follows that with his typical by no means. May it never be. This is Paul's way of saying absolutely not. So he gives you the question in a way that says you should say no to this. And then he follows it up with absolutely not. And he presents himself as exhibit A for his evidence that God has not rejected his people. He says, for I myself am an Israelite, a descendant of Abraham, a member of the tribe of Benjamin. This is the language from the beginning of chapter 9. The people that have all these privileges in Romans 9:4. Paul is a member of that people. He is a descendant of Abraham, like Paul talked about in Romans 9:7. So what Paul is kind of subtly doing is saying that he is actually that Israel within Israel. He's a part of the Israel within Israel. This is a way, even by his wording, that he's establishing that what God did in the past is what he's doing in the present. And he even adds that he's a proud member of the tribe of Benjamin. So his fellow Jewish people at the time, they were those that knew where they'd come from. They cherished that identity. And Paul's among them. He cherishes his identity as a member of that people. And then he emphasizes his answer. So he's not only said it rhetorically, he said absolutely not to this, but now he just says it explicitly in verse 2. God has not rejected his people. And those words actually have a history in the Bible. The idea, the subject of God rejecting his people is actually found throughout the Old Testament. And not in every case in a positive way. I mean, that was the threat, because Israel kept failing. And so there was always the threat that God would reject them. And in fact, sometimes when it talks about God's punishment of Israel, it's described as a rejection. So at times, the Old Testament actually talks about God rejecting his people. But it did that alongside an understanding that God would not do that permanently. And I think Lamentations 3:31 is the best example. This is the quintessential rejection of God's people that Jeremiah is describing. The exile to Babylon. And this is what Jeremiah says, for the Lord will not reject forever. Maybe times of rejection, but it's not going to be permanent. And that's what Paul, that's the basis for Paul's statement here. So Paul's wording actually looks even more similar to 1 Samuel 12:22. If you remember that story, those stories, that's where Israel had rejected the Lord's rule. They had rejected him as king because they wanted a king like the nations. And so Samuel gives this farewell address, and he promises that even though they failed, the Lord will not reject his people. Why? Why does Samuel say that? Samuel says it because of the same reason God didn't reject his people after the golden calf incident, same reason he didn't reject them after their refusal to enter the land. It's for the sake of his name, because the Lord chose to make them his people. It was the Lord's choice to make them his people that is the reason why he has not rejected them. And that is exactly what Paul alludes to here with the words, whom he foreknew. So I know it's very common, because people are concerned about things like God's sovereignty and salvation and concerns about fairness, when we hear foreknew, for the most part, people jump to the idea that it's talking about knowing something beforehand, knowing about something beforehand. But this term, this idea of knowing, isn't just used that way. It's actually used throughout the Old Testament even for Israel in a way that means choosing or selecting someone in advance. That's how God knew his people in the Old Testament. So for example, Genesis 18:19, in the ESV it reads, I have chosen him. Actual wording in the Hebrew is, I have known him. And then in Amos 3:2, speaking of Israel, God says, you only have I known of all the families of the earth. Obviously, God knows of all the families of the earth. He knows about them. What he's saying there is that he knows them. He's chosen them as his people. So that's what Paul's talking about here. So it should go without saying that God is not going to reject his people whom he knew beforehand, whom he chose beforehand. God has made his choice. He's not going to revoke it. And Paul is actually proof of that. Paul, even though the majority rejected their king, God has not rejected them. Paul's faith showed that because God showed Paul mercy, called him to believe in Christ. So that's the same way that God's acted in the past. That's what Paul then illustrates with this instance from the story with Elijah, which comes from 1 Kings 19. It says, as Paul puts it, Elijah was appealing to God against Israel. Elijah is upset with Israel. He's arguing against them. And you might remember the story. So Elijah has been speaking for God as a prophet. He's been standing up to the prophets of Baal. He's been condemning this ungodly king of Israel, Ahab, and his pagan wife, Jezebel. But now Jezebel's done. She wants to kill Elijah. And he's on the run. He's not just on the run, though. He's giving up. So Elijah tells the Lord that he's had enough and just take his life. And it's at that point that the Lord sends him on a journey to Mount Sinai, to Horeb, as it's known. The historic revelation of God at Mount Sinai, that's where he sends Elijah. And then he asks Elijah when he gets there, what are you doing here? Which would be a little disconcerting, right? Well, you told me to come. But see, Elijah knows that the question is really about this whole thing. It's about his state of mind. Now, he doesn't actually think it's simply his state of mind, though. He believes that it has to do with what he records here in verse 3, or what Paul quotes in verse 3. This is his response to the Lord when he's asked, what are you doing here? Lord, they have killed your prophets. They have demolished your altars, and I alone am left, and they seek my life. And then the Lord tells him, okay, hang on, just stay right here. And he has this theophany where, you know, there's wind, and there's an earthquake, and there's fire. Only God isn't in any of those things. He's in a still, small, audible voice. Still, small, audible voice that any of us could have heard if we were standing there, not inside himself. And in that voice, he asks him again, what are you doing here? And again, Elijah gives this response. He's saying, Israel's rejected the worship of God, the one true God, and they've silenced his voice by killing the prophets so that only Elijah's left. That's what he thinks, and he thinks that he's the only faithful Israelite left. And now they're trying to snuff out that one remnant, that singular remnant too. It's interesting, though, Paul uses this situation because it has this terminology. He says, I alone am left. Left is a word related to the word remnant. And then he turns to God's response, and he doesn't include all of it. He just skips down to where, again, you see the terminology of remnant. Now, he sets up this quote of 1 Kings 19:18 in a kind of unique way that translations don't exactly know what to do with because it's kind of hard to convey everything. But it seems like the best way to understand the actual wording is that this is God's authoritative response to what Elijah's said. This is his pronouncement. God is now going to clarify what's really going on. Now, Elijah truly has been through it. I mean, it is clear. He's gone through some terribly difficult things. But he's not focusing on the fact that his God is still on the throne. The Hebrew rendering of this verse suggests that it's describing the future of what God's going to do with the Jewish people. Paul translates it, the significance of it in light of what it actually says. So he gives this promise that he will leave 7,000 knees in Israel that have not bent to Baal. But if that's true, then he has already kept for himself 7,000 men who have not bowed the knee to Baal. And that's the way Paul puts it. And once again, the term kept could be translated left. It is related to the term remnant. So Elijah wasn't the only faithful Israelite, but that wasn't because of the courage of these 7,000 men. It's not to say that they weren't courageous, but it is to say that the Lord's drawing attention to something different. The Lord pointed to his action with these men. In fact, the Hebrew form of the verb here suggests that it says God caused these 7,000 men to remain. Not just that they were left behind, but he caused them to remain. He caused them to remain loyal to him, which makes it easy for Paul to make a connection here. Those who hadn't bent their knee to Baal, in essence, really, they had bent their knee to the Lord. They had been loyal to the Lord. They hadn't committed allegiance to Baal. They were loyal to him. So while the majority of Israel in Elijah's day had bent their knee to Baal, they had not bent their knee to the Lord, there was a minority that had been loyal, a remnant. And Paul says that in his day, this is equally true. The majority of Israel had not been loyal to the Lord by bending their knee to the Messiah. But God had caused a minority to remain loyal to him by their submission to Jesus as Lord. And so that's what he concludes in verse 5. He says, so too, at the present time, there is a remnant chosen by grace. And again, the ESV's done a great job of translating this, but a more literal rendering of that last part is that it says according to, or more likely, because of an election of grace. So a remnant has happened in the now time. That's the way it's worded, which is a phrase that Paul used in chapter 3 and verse 26 about this momentous fulfillment of Christ's arrival in the now time. In the now time, God has done this. A remnant has happened because of an election of grace. So just as with Elijah, though here he states it explicitly, in the present, there is a remnant as a result of election. And that is a matter of grace. That's what Paul says here. It's an undeserved choice by God that resulted in a remnant of Jewish people who believe in their Messiah while the majority do not. That's what Paul states here. Paul emphasizes the undeserved nature of this in verse 6. He says, but if it is by grace, it is no longer on the basis of works. Otherwise, grace would no longer be grace. And so by grace, he's repeating this idea. It's based on grace. God's choice was based on grace. His choice was not, it did not come from any works that people do. Now that word no longer, if you're reading that, it doesn't just give people today in English a little bit of trouble. Even the Greek speaking copyists were uncomfortable with that word because it kind of sounded like it's saying that, well, once it was on the basis of works. But that's not what it's saying. The word can be used logically. And so as Leon Morris puts it, Paul is saying that once we have come to see that salvation is by grace, there is no longer any place for works. When God leaves for himself people like Paul on the basis of his undeserved kindness, then it obviously can't be based on what Paul is going to do. It isn't based on anything in Paul. Otherwise, he'd deserve it. It would no longer be grace. So the stress of this is on the fact that the basis for God's choice lies with God, not on the people who benefit from it. That's the same thing he was arguing in chapter 9. And again, I know that's a disconcerting thing. We talked about it in chapter 9. But understand what Paul is stressing here in this section. He's stressing not that we should put our confidence in people, right? The point of this passage is that we can put our confidence in God. This is actually part of Paul's evidence that God has not rejected his people. So how can you know that in the present God is not through with Israel? Because of the remnant. That proves that God is not done with them. He's not saying that Jewish people aren't through with God. He's saying God is not through with Jewish people. So there's really no way to retain the sense of Paul's argument if you're going to interject that it really comes down to the faith of the remnant. That's the decisive difference. Tim Keller puts it this way. What guarantees that there will always be a faithful remnant is not that there is always a set of good, decent people who will believe, but rather that there is always the grace of God. It is God who preserves a remnant. Those who believe do so entirely because of his grace. That's the only way we can have confidence. So if the stress of our theology is to maintain human priority in salvation, in other words, if what we're trying to maintain is the fact that it really comes down to who chooses God and not whom God chooses, then we actually can't have any confidence that there is going to be a remnant of Jewish believers throughout time. We can't be confident of that. God can't guarantee something if it's actually up to the Jewish people to do it. The only way for God to guarantee that this is evidence that he's not done with Israel is if he is the basis for this remnant, the existence of this remnant. And so in the same way, I would encourage you not to set your hopes on humanity as the ultimate basis for why we know God's going to keep his plans with every tribe, language, people, and nation. We can have absolute confidence in what God promises in Revelation, not because we can have any confidence in humanity. We can only have confidence in that if it comes down to God and his grace. Not if it comes down to us, but if it comes down to God. When it's based on God's grace, we don't just have a hesitant hope, like I think it's going to happen. We can have a confident hope that looks forward to God accomplishing this with certainty. So do not put your trust in people. Put your hope in God. The God who shows undeserved kindness when he saves people, including the remnant in Israel that he has promised to save. So has God rejected Israel? No. The proof in the present is that God has chosen a remnant. But there's another side to this. So Paul goes on to explain the reality of only a remnant. What that calls for, it calls for an explanation of the rest of Israel. What's happened to the rest of Israel? So the second part of Paul's argument for why God has not rejected his people is to explain the present state of the majority. God has hardened the rest of Israel. He's chosen a remnant of Israel, but hardened the rest. Now, we're going to go on to see in chapter 11, the rest of it, that this plays a major part in explaining what God's doing right now with Israel and what he's going to do with them, where this is all headed. So he's going to explain this more, but for now he's just telling us about what's happening. And once again, he makes this transition in verse 7, what then? This is the kind of transition that he makes. And he reminds us of his previous argument. He's already talked about how Israel failed to obtain what it was seeking back in that middle section, or actually the beginning of it, Romans 9, 30 through 10, 4. What were they seeking? They were seeking righteousness. They were seeking that righteous status that we do need to be accepted by God to escape punishment on judgment day. But they were seeking that the wrong way. And so Paul comes back to saying that they didn't obtain it. They didn't get it. But he's explaining that it's not the entire nation that didn't get that righteousness. Earlier he was saying, as a whole, the nation did not get that righteousness. And that's a legitimate thing when you're talking about the majority. The majority, the nation as a whole, didn't experience that righteous status. But that's not saying that no one did. Absolutely no Jewish person experienced that. That's not what Paul meant. And so what he's saying now, he's clarifying, saying how the remnant relates to what's happening now with the majority. So in a sense, Israel has two parts to it. That's what he's explaining. There's what he calls the election and the rest. And because it doesn't make sense to us to say the election, translations translate it the elect, but the word is not actually elect, it's election. The election and the rest. The reason why he chooses that wording is to stress this is God's activity. We could translate it the choosing, but it's stressing God's activity in this. So those God chose are the ones who obtained a righteous status, that righteous status that everybody was seeking, and the rest were hardened. And once again, if what Paul's doing, you see him do at the beginning, he comes back to it at the end. He made a contrast in Romans 9, 18 between those who experience God's mercy and those whom God hardens. And he's coming back to that, only here he refers to, instead of mercy, those whom God has chosen and those who God has hardened. And so when it comes to Israel, this hardening is specifically for Israel. This is where you experience this language. This is where Paul talks about this. So this is not to say in every case God either elects or hardens. There's a specific thing Paul's doing here with this language. When it comes to Israel, the beneficiaries of a covenant relationship with God and the revelation that came with that, that specific group, this specific circumstance calls for either election or hardening. So if we look back to Pharaoh, who had the same experience, also related to revelation in the form of plagues and things, God had a specific purpose for why he was hardening Pharaoh, specifically in that situation. And he's going to go on to explain in chapter 11 why God is doing this with Israel, hardening the non-elect in Israel. And we're going to see that purpose later. But for now, he points to the Jewish scriptures to show that this is true, to explain this. And he does it from all the Jewish scriptures. This is God's plan. And so in order to make his case, he does it with a good Jewish argument from the three parts of the Hebrew scriptures. He points to the law, the prophets, and the writings. So in Hebrew, you refer to those as the Torah, the Nevi'im, and the Ketuvim. If you take the first letter of each of those, Ta, Torah, Nevi'im, Na, and Ketuvim, Ka, is where people get the word Tanakh. That's how the Jewish people refer to their Bibles, the Tanakh. Paul's taking from the T, the N, and the K, taking from all of them in order to make his case here. He first takes from the law and the prophets together, Deuteronomy 29:4 and Isaiah 29:10. If you go here, this is the thing, what happens with Paul. You read his allusions, his quotes, and you see, he kind of changes the language of them. And honestly, before that was unnerving to me until I realized just how great of an exegete Paul is. And what he's doing is he's taking this, what God is doing, he's following the themes, and he's showing what they're really talking about and how it comes to today. So Deuteronomy 24, 29:4 says, but to this day the Lord has not given you a heart to understand or eyes to see or ears to hear, which is a theme that gets played out continually. But Paul now, he explains the significance of this by connecting it to Isaiah and what God says there, and he changes it to a positive, what God has in fact given them. So the context of Deuteronomy, where he's quoting, is where Moses is basically giving this overview of Israel. He's talked about where they've been, their past, their present condition. And then he goes on to say what's going to happen to them in the future. Because of their present condition, because of their past, it showed that they're a stubborn people. In the future, they're going to face exile. It's set. It's going to happen. But all along the way, there's no point at which the fact that they have this heart that needs circumcision, Moses in no way suggests, well, you know, it's really not your fault. This is not your responsibility. He does blame them for their failure. It is their fault. And God is leaving them in this state. And Paul, he says that what Moses talked about there in Deuteronomy is related to what God told Isaiah in, first of all, in chapter 6, when he describes the same situation with having faulty eyes and ears. Same thing that Isaiah is supposed to prophesy, and their ears and eyes are supposed to not work. They're not supposed to be responsive. And so then in Isaiah 29:10, you see the fulfillment of that. And Paul alludes to that with the words, a spirit of stupor. So just, again, Paul's not just quoting Deuteronomy and Isaiah. He's piecing this together so that we understand what God is doing with Israel. What Israel needed, Paul's already said, they need changed hearts. That's that middle section there, Romans 10, 5 through 13. That, he says, is solved in Christ. What they need is essentially Christ. But God has handed his old covenant people over to that sinful state, just as he did with Pharaoh. He made them insensitive to revelation. That's the description. So their spirit is stupefied. They're unable to use their minds the way that they should. Their eyes and ears don't work right. They're unable to respond to this and to understand and to react to this revelation that God has provided. And then Paul adds to this from Psalm 69, which is a very important psalm in the New Testament. This is one that is quoted and alluded to a lot. David in Psalm 69 is calling for God to punish his people for rejecting him, the Messiah, the anointed one. He's calling on God to punish them, not because he's so taken up with himself, but because he's the king, and he points to God's authority. And so the New Testament repeatedly points to this. Psalm 69:21 is alluded to during Jesus' crucifixion. It's the next two verses that Paul then quotes. And I would say, in terms of understanding why the Psalms are used for a prophecy of the Messiah, David understood that his experience was also going to relate to this future descendant who would reign forever on his throne. So David understood his role as the anointed one, and that's why this rejection was such a problem. So the future anointed one, which is what Messiah and Christ means, the future Messiah's rejection is where David's words are going to find their greatest fulfillment. And that's what Paul is doing. So the first punishment that David calls for in verse 22 of Psalm 69 flows out of verse 21. And in verse 21, it talks about this poisonous food that and drink that they're giving David and giving the Lord, the Messiah. And so the point that David is making in verse 22 is this attitude towards him is going to be turned over to them. They're going to experience the just results of rejecting him. So he uses, even in that passage, a word that Paul used previously, the stone of stumbling, rock of offense. Here he mentions the stumbling again. Because they've rejected the Messiah, that rejection is going to come back on them. They're going to experience the just repayment of rejecting the Messiah. So in other words, there's a kind of a comparison with what Israel did to David and what they're going to experience because of that. It's another case where God's trying to say, they're getting what they deserve. They did this, and now this is what they deserve. And then he gives this second punishment, and this is where Paul's making the connection from Deuteronomy and Isaiah. Their eyes, again, cannot see. So, and then he also compares to the fact that they haven't bent their knee. This kind of brings back with Elijah. Because they haven't bent their knee to the Lord, they're going to bend their backs. So, again, what Paul is saying is that the majority of Israel is experiencing this hardness justly. That's really the point he's trying to make. From Deuteronomy to Isaiah to Psalms, what they're experiencing is perfectly consistent with their behavior. It's what they should experience for rejecting the Messiah. So this is fitting. They don't deserve God's intervention. They don't deserve his kindness. They don't deserve this revelation that they've experienced. And that's true for us too, right? We actually don't, it's not just that we don't deserve salvation. We don't even deserve to hear about it, which I think is a confusion that some people have. Everybody deserves to hear about the good news. No, they don't. The Bible never presents that as an idea. None of us deserve salvation. None of us deserve to even hear about salvation. That's the consistent teaching of the Bible. And that's the problem that we have with this hardening is a problem to accept that truth that I just said, that we don't deserve to hear the good news. If we could accept that that is a grace of God, this would be a little bit more understandable for us. So I think it's this privilege that Israel has experienced that is why they are hardened now. Why this is not referred to for other people, but Israel has this privilege of having this revelation, and it's being taken away from them. God doesn't, zap them with some light so that their memory goes away. He doesn't take away physical copies of the Bible, but they have this amazing privilege that he's mentioned before. They've had something that nobody else has had, the oracles of God, all pointing to Christ. And when he came, they rejected him. And so what God is doing in hardening his people is taking that away. He didn't give it to the rest of the nations. Nobody else got it. So because they took that gift and still crucified their Messiah, he's taking it away from them. That is the nature of the hardening. I think it's unfortunate that the ESV translates a word in verse 10 as forever. I think the NET and the N and the CSB are actually correct in translating it continually. It's not only the legitimate way to translate it in Greek, but it also matches the Hebrew word in Psalm 69. Because this is not going to be a permanent reality. Paul's going to go on to say that. It is true, however, in the present time. So I think the first thing that this reality should do for us is to recognize that there are limitations when you hear the gospel. I think there are a lot of people, especially in our world where, the gospel is heard all the time, and so people will say, I've heard that before, and you know what, before I die, I'll take care of it, I'll respond. And what this shows us is, no, you don't have that. You shouldn't think that you can just get right with God before you die. But there are situations where that privilege of hearing the good news that you don't deserve can be taken away from you. And you will not have that opportunity when you die. That is the first thing I think we should recognize about this. That's why the author of Hebrews repeatedly quotes Psalm 95:7 that says, "Today if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts." Do you hear his voice? Can you hear, as it were, Jesus calling to you through this good news about him? That he is the Lord, that he has done what you could never do for yourself. And he's provided a righteous status. He's provided forgiveness. Can you see that? Can you see that? If you believe, then you will be reunited with God through Jesus' death and resurrection. So today, if you hear his voice, believe it. You have no guarantee that you will ever hear it again. Because you can have ears that don't hear. You can have a spirit that is stupefied, that does not understand. If you hear it, believe it. Now, for those who do believe in this Jewish divine Messiah, do not hate his chosen people, whom he foreknew. And I would say it's clear that the language of chosen people can be equally appropriate for God's new covenant people, the church. But it is still appropriate in a different way for God's old covenant people, Israel. They remain, in this sense, a chosen people. God is not through with them. And it's actually our own Judy Schwartz who is our personal piece of evidence that God is not done with Israel. Judy is a part of God's remnant. She is a personal piece of evidence from God that he is not done with the Jewish people. Now, does that mean we should always support all the present nation of Israel's decisions and actions? No, it does not. That is an inappropriate application of this text. It's just like our Jewish guide explained. Israel is a secular state. The majority of people in Israel right now don't even follow Judaism. So there's no reason we should expect their governmental decisions to always be right. Now, there may be other reasons politically why we would say we should do this and support this. But the issue here is about love, not about an unqualified decision to support everything that Israel does no matter what. They're an unbelieving nation. That's not the way they'll always be. But it is how they are now. It is, however, a travesty to hate Jewish people and to hate Israel. That is absolutely wrong. And that is driving a lot of people's attitudes towards Israel politically. And it should not be a part of the way that we think, even politically, about Israel. Paul's going to go on to say in Romans 11:28, they are beloved by God. And we should love them too. Even as we love people from every nation, language, tribe, and people whom God also loves. And so if we love them, we should tell them about Yeshua HaMashiach. We should tell them about the Lord Jesus Christ, even as we tell others about him. Join me in prayer. Jesus, you came to earth through the Jewish people. They are still your people, even though you also have embraced and are embracing and will embrace some from every family, every people group in the world. But help us to not misunderstand what has happened when you came to your own and your own did not receive you. I know these ideas, they are somewhat technical in a way, that they're talking about just trying to understand how you relate to Israel. But even if they're technical, that doesn't make them unimportant. You've revealed this through Paul. He is your spokesman. He speaks for you. Because this is important for us Goyim, us Gentiles to hear. So I pray that we would recognize how wrong, how sinister, how diabolical it is to be anti-Semitic. That we would recognize that reflex. It's kind of a way to reject you by rejecting your people. So help us not to follow suit. And we know we shouldn't hate anyone. But there's this odd thing where your people are just hated. Even as people hate Christians, and we see that as well. But your people specifically, throughout the centuries, have been picked out and oppressed and mistreated. So even though we know that only a remnant is going to believe, help us to still love your people. Help us to never fall into the attitude of what Luther fell into. Grant us a continued love for your people. Help us to continue to point them to you, even as we point others to you. And we do pray for anyone here who does not yet know you, that they would hear you speaking this morning through this word about you. And that by the power of your word, they would experience new life. Amen.